Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast is up and going for episode 198. And for those following along at home, if you count the, the zeroth episode, the origin story episode, and if you count 12 A or B, depending on which one you normally count, this ends up being the 200th episode, even though it's labeled 198. So we're calling it the Animal Style Fries 200th episode.
Secret menu episode.
I think Animal Style Fries has to be my favorite thing from the secret menu, although a very close second has to be getting the chilies in the burger, because you can get like a cup of like banana peppers, but you can also get them in the burger. Totally worth it.
No, nothing beats animal fries.
And nothing beats this podcast. We've been doing it for 200 episodes. It's still kind of a nice thing in the middle of the week for me. That's a lot of episodes.
That's a lot of talking.
Yep. We're still formulating plans. They're sort of coming together about the 200th episode. I think we have an idea of what it's going to be, or at least we've always had an idea of what it's going to be. It's just going to be like even more awesome because we've actually started.
We totally know everything. Yes. And it's all planned out. Don't worry about it.
Advanced planning is a thing on the Not a Thing podcast. So we're going to start the episode off with the words thank you, which apparently we can now use without fear of reprisal from Citigroup and AT&T. So this week brought forth some news about a lawsuit fight between Citigroup and AT&T. I guess Citigroup somehow trademarked the or I'm not sure if it's a trademark, but they I think they copyrighted because I
no,
think
it was trademark.
It was trademark. They tried to trademark thank you, and then proceeded to sue AT&T for diluting their brand by also thanking their customers by using the words thank you. I think AT&T countersued by saying that's stupid because it is, but then they went further and then tried to copyright the word thanks as kind of a countermeasure. All I can say is thank you to both of those companies for deciding that was really not a thing and dropping both sides of the suit so it becomes an unenforceable trademark, because that's really not a thing.
Corporations are totally fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the words thank you are enough in the vernacular that they're not really associated with a brand, so it's probably silly to try and allow that to go.
That's more like a peace among worlds kind of thing. Thank you.
Right. Bless your heart. Well, kind of moving on from thanks to something we're sort of saying no thanks to, some news out of Russia, and it's not the normal news about them hacking into various things or otherwise subverting forums with like the click farms of people, as we talked about in an insert episode here. Instead, we're talking about a new store that's opening at the Moscow airport, and it's the Kalashnikov store. Kalashnikov is in the maker of the ever famous AK-47 rifle. So I guess it's kind of it. I mean, the AK has some. I mean, it's been made since 1947. That's what the 47 is in AK-47, and there've been, you know, thousands, maybe even millions made. So it's a recognizable brand in that respect. And so Kalashnikov is cashing in on it by opening a store where they're going to sell like shirts and logo wear and probably like mugs and, you know, general travel tchotchkes. I mean, it's in an airport, so you can think what they have in the souvenir stands at an airport. But more notably, what they're also selling is replica firearms that look like you know, and weigh the same. At least that's what the article said. That their size and weight compatible models of the AK-47 and other firearms by Kalashnikov. And when asked about, you know, is this a good idea, selling replica guns in an airport, and the response was, they clearly look like replicas. I don't know. I mean, with the
that seems like a bad idea.
It kind of does. So as far as I know, they are not, you know, carrying them on into the United States would probably not fly. Ha ha. But it does look like the store is open and running. There is an online store if you can read Russian. I cannot, so I kind of stumbled around a little bit, and there are lots of pictures of stuff and, like, you know, what looks like kind of fun activewear that has all sorts of camouflage on it. So it kind of just looks like it would be something at home at a Bass Pro Shop. Except you're buying the bad guy guns. Everyone knows the AKs are the bad guy guns, if you've played any games at all.
They're going to tell you to get off their plane.
kind of moving over to the U.S. In terms of different governments and federal intervention into things. The federal government, the Justice Department, has decided to say that for-profit prisons are not a thing. And this is at the federal level. So it's something like 22,000 inmates. They're closing down, or they're saying that the conditions at the privately run prisons are not safe for the inmates, and then also the workers that are there. And private prisons are somewhat controversial because they're privately run, and so, you know, in the era of privatization of things, they're you know, they offered supposedly a service that would be cheaper and better than whatever the public kind of running of them would be. And after an investigation and someone looking into it, looks like it's neither of those things. And so they're closing that down. And again, that's at the federal level. There's still private prisons run at the state level, and it also does not apply to a couple other federal level things like INS and the U.S. Marshal Service. But private prisons are really not a thing. I think it's you know, it's in their best interest as a privately owned and running company that's trying to turn a profit to keep inmates in those prisons. And so they often have lobbying power into making laws that sentence people and get people into prison, and that's generally bad. I think there are some people that probably do need to be in the prison system, but I think privatization of it makes that number bigger than it should be, because the more people in prisons, the more money the private prisons make. So there's got to be a conflict of interest in there somewhere, and I think the federal government is not coming out and saying that by this action, but it's being heavily inferred by a lot of folks, and hopefully it's something that trickles down to the state level on that. Kind of in talking about private prisons, and one of the things that that they often lobby for are laws that end up turning into racial profiling and really bad stuff like that. And that racial profiling can bleed over not only into law enforcement, but via the media and everything else into just general people's consciousness about how things go. And one of there's a social network called Nextdoor that I'm actually a member of. I don't know if you are in where you live, but it works by making kind of a close, like you can think of it like a closed Facebook group of the people that are in your neighborhood. So in like a 3-block radius of your house, so one street over in each direction, and that's your next door community, and it ends up being a kind of, it's meant to be kind of a like know your neighbors, and you know, if you have stuff for sale, you can post things about garage sales or like, you know, small jobs in the area or things like that. What, in my experience, it ends up becoming kind of a police blotter or a pre-crime blotter in some respects, because what we'll see is people saying, oh, I saw a car kind of creeping down the street, and all the occupants were huddled down, you know, so they couldn't be seen. The license plate is blah, 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 blah. Be on the lookout. And that's what you'll see. It's kind of a neighborhood watch thing, which I think is okay, but it sometimes goes too far. Often it goes too far in that Nextdoor is releasing some new tools to stop what is commonly happening on the site, which is a lot of racial profiling. And what will happen is the only identifying piece of information that's given about a suspicious person is their race, and that's not useful. It's not useful on its own unless you live in an area where there is no one of that race. And even then, it's you're still, people can walk through neighborhoods. It happens. Like I did that yesterday. I walked, you know, 3 blocks, and I was in what probably would have been another next door neighborhood. I'm probably on their forum somewhere. Asian man with orange hair walk through my neighborhood today at 3 p.m. Something like that. But
possible Saiyan.
But what Nextdoor is doing is they have a kind of incident reporting form, for example, when you say like, oh, I saw something happening, you can describe all of the things, and you have checkboxes about, or not checkboxes, but fields about like what they were wearing or their height or what kind of car they were driving. But if you tick the race box and fill that in, it requires you to fill in at least one more piece of information, which I think is the barest minimum to do. Nextdoor is really interesting in that, at least where I am, the majority of folks in there are the homeowners. There are some people that rent and are active on it, but the majority are homeowners, and it's it can be a little jarring, or it was a little jarring for me to see how kind of, I mean, protective is the good way to put it, but I think overzealously kind of binoculars in the window is what I'm seeing for like surveilling of the neighborhood at large and being it's surprising, right? I mean, this is maybe the first time these folks are on the internet or something, and they're being very outspoken about a lot of things, about you know, the homeless that are in the area that sometimes come through, the like people that are driving around supposedly doing drugs or whatever, and they can be pretty mean about what they say. I don't understand how they get away with this, in that there are neighbors. We know where you live. It's literally in your profile description. Be a little, you know, more empathetic to the people that live in your neighborhood, I think, is what it comes down to. I'm glad Nextdoor's taken this step, because it was a continuous kind of, like, not joy exactly, more more like, oh, these are my neighbors kind of gut check that I would, because I was one of the first, I think, five people to sign up for Nextdoor for my little block. So I'm designated a lead, even though I don't do anything in that capacity other than I see all of the flagged emails or flagged posts where someone said, like, oh, those damn Orientals are in my trash again, which is an actual thing I read on Nextdoor within the last 3 years. So it's good. I'm glad people are being a little more thoughtful about what they say, or at least the Nextdoor is taking steps to kind of look at that and work with that.
Maybe as a street officer, you should get a flag for your house.
No, let's say no, actually.
How about a beret?
Yeah, right. I have to start wearing the dress whites uniforms with the mirror sunglasses, and I just walk out onto the, like, the roof and kind of proclaim the law of the land.
I was thinking more Jean-Claude Van Damme from Street Fighter.
'Cause who of you wants to go home?
Then go up the river.
Oh, man. Well, speaking of neighborhoods, we're going to go to a neighborhood in Hayward. This story was found by my sister and my brother-in-law, the geologist, who we kind of called out last episode a little bit. And so this episode they brought to our attention a curb that's in Hayward that was actually built over the fault that's there in the 50s. And it was, like, perfectly aligned. So the fault is where the red curb meets the corner where it starts to curve. And those are generally two pieces of cement or whatever they make the curbs out of. And so that join lined up perfectly with the fault. So as the fault had been moving, it had just been separating, and it looked like a mistake. It looked like, you know, they had poured the concrete, you know, 8 inches in the wrong place after so many years of it moving. It was moving something like, what is it, half, like a quarter inch a year or something to that effect. So it's it was pretty significant. And geologists would go there, and they would kind of use it as a local landmark of, look, this is real, plate tectonics is a thing. And apparently the city, in its move to add wheelchair accessible curbs, broke it up and is repouring the concrete with a ramp. So whoops. I don't know if geologists and the city ever had a relationship to say, like, hey, this is a thing and we want to kind of keep it, or if it was just kind of a quietly circulated, like, haha, let's go down to the curb at such and such and see how much it's moved this week. I like to think they're like roving gangs of geologists that kind of meet and, like, you know, go to these places and, like, drink and smoke weed and whatever.
Hayward's like their Burning Man for geologists.
Well, hopefully there are other examples of plate tectonics and something that can be maybe even city sponsored that doesn't end up getting kind of torn up by overzealous city planners. Although wheelchair accessible ramps are a thing, I think that's actually something good. They've been adding those to curbs around here too. I don't think any of these are affected by fault motion though, so I haven't heard about it on Nextdoor anyway. We'll see.
They're real helpful. I have to carry a roller suitcase at work, and those ramps are handy.
Moving over, actually very far over, we're going to stop talking about land and the earth at all. We're going to go and jump into some water. It's actually potentially safer to go into the water now. Sorry, Jaws.
You won't convince me.
So a company in New Zealand that makes wetsuits is making a wetsuit that has a carbon fiber weave in it that I guess I don't know if it's purely carbon fiber or if there's any kind of metal in it at all, but what it supposedly does is that it makes a mesh that will block the electrical signals that come from your body. And the reason that that's a thing is because sharks and other marine life can sense that. Dolphins and sea turtles and stingrays and whatnot can sense the electrical impulses of other fish. That's how they find their prey, or they locate predators that are seeking them and are able to run away. And so what this suit allows divers to do is to get a lot closer to marine life that would otherwise be spooked or would otherwise want to eat them. And so in the article, they show the divers just hanging out with some sharks, which I think is impressive. I'm not 100% sure I would trust the suit alone, because it is just one sense that the sharks have. I mean, they also, you know, do all sorts of stuff beyond just sense the electrical impulses. But that is in and of itself pretty impressive. I had not thought of that as a you know, a thing like, oh, that's what I have to do. I have to put like this they call it a stealth wetsuit.
It's like a Faraday cage,
right? Exactly, to protect you from sharks. But I wonder if it also protects those animals, because you're not you know, whatever noisy electrical thing you are in the water. I don't.
Yeah,
I don't
know. If I'm going in the water with sharks, I still want a cage.
Yeah, like a cage, not a Faraday cage.
No, I want both.
The oxygen tanks at the ready with the sniper rifle in the crow's nest, just ready to go, because you never know, sharks. I was reminded of Jaws not too long ago. I was watching, I think it was a Rick and Morty episode, and for whatever reason, it's like post-apocalyptic kind of moment, and one of them is reenacting Quint's speech about the naval crew that was thrown off the boat, and then the sharks.
The U.S. Indianapolis.
Yes. The shark's eyes are like a doll's eyes, black and lifeless. it's a good movie. It probably deserves a rewatch. Even with the knowledge of the electricity proof sharks, you would just have to make a movie where the sharks figured out how to deal with them. That's a
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that movie's called Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
It's a cinema master. Starring LL Cool J and Tom Jane.
Exactly. See?
And Saffron Burroughs.
It's a thing. So we're going to move.
Yeah, watch Jaws and you'll be afraid of the water because you barely see a shark. Mm-hmm. Watch Deep Blue Sea and the sea will never intimidate you again.
Well, speaking of the sea, but not the sea as in the ocean. We're talking about sea as in, I'm not sure if I'm going to do this.
Yeah, let's see how you do this. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no. Well, it's Alpha Centauri C, also known as Proxima Centauri, the third of the three stars that make up the Alpha Centauri star system, which is the next closest star system to Earth. Or to the solar system, to our solar system. It's actually three stars, Alpha Centauri A, B, and C. A and B are the big bright ones, but they're so far away, when you look at them with the naked eye, it just looks like one big star. Turns out there's a third star, Alpha Centauri C, which is just nicknamed Proxima Centauri, because it's kind of, I guess, tinier and less bright. It's a red dwarf star, so it's tiny, but still got some heat. And astronomers have figured out that there is kind of a wiggle. There was a wiggle in the motion of that star, and there was a project called the Pale Red Dot Project, kind of referring to Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot about the Earth. This was the project to find the Pale Red Dot, which is Proxima Centauri. The reason they wanted to check out that wobble was the reason a star might wobble is gravitational fluctuations around it caused by an orbiting planet. And so they've done enough measurements and can state with confidence that there is not only a planet orbiting Proxima Centauri, they're calling it preliminarily Proxima B, which I don't know where A went, but Proxima B is a planet that's there, and based on the magnitude of Proxima Centauri as a star and the amount of wobble they're getting, they are suspecting that the planet is probably within what's called the habitable zone for that star, and the habitable zone is defined as there's kind of this wide band of space where if water were to form on that planet, it would not necessarily just evaporate and go away. It's potentially sustaining an atmosphere and water, which means that there could be life on that planet. So it's interesting that they've discovered an exoplanet. They've discovered exoplanets before, but this is one that's reasonably close. It's still real far away. It's 4 light years away, but it is the closest one that we can get to. So 4 light years away means 4 years at the speed of light. And we've not quite gotten to the speed of light with rocketry and such. There was an article that I'd read earlier in the week about the closest theoretical speed that they think that they can achieve is something like 1/20th the speed of light. So it'd still take 20 times, or a 20th, or I don't know, a fifth times four. It's like 20 years to get. No, that doesn't make sense. 20th of the speed of light, that'd be 80 years. Yes. Yes.
But that's doable.
It's doable. It would take a long time, and I don't think
it would take 80 years. But
I think that I think that long time does not factor in how to stop it. That assumes we can accelerate it to 1/20th of the speed of light, and then I think it just assumes that when you get to where you want to go, you'll figure out how to stop it. So the theory would be to use a solar sail of sorts. You use a photon what is it? Particle? Yes, particle engine. Where you just shoot light lasers and stuff at a sail, and then it just keeps pushing it. It takes a long time to accelerate, but you can get it real fast, apparently, a 20th the speed of light. But yeah.
I'll just wait for the Alcubierre warp drive.
Well, in theory, if we can throw at least something out there, maybe it would throw something back in the amount of time it would take us to figure out how to get people out there. This all assumes that we'll get, you know, NASA will get, you know, funding, or that commercial entities will completely privatize space exploration and travel. And we'll, some combination of that will still be around 80 years from now in order to get it there. And then I guess 4 more years for the signal to get back of if it worked or not. And then another 80 years for us to, you know, throw some people out there. But we'll see. We'll see. Maybe in 164 years we'll need to move. I don't know. I think we need to move now, but part of that is just because I want to go to space. Getting to space is a thing. It almost doesn't matter how or why. there was also another story kind of in line with that this week, that the International Space Station, NASA, is looking to eventually turn over the International Space Station to probably a commercial entity once they've figured out, you know, how all of that will work. Boeing, which I guess designed the International Space Station as it is, and is kind of in charge of you know, maintenance and upkeep, had some estimate about, like, they're you know, in, you know, there's a lifespan for how long they wanted it up there because of, you know, parts and everything else and maintenance and costs for replacing things or fixing things. And it's already coming up to that that first kind of expiration date. So I can see why NASA wants to turn it over. They want to flip that house. We'll see if they can do it. I know that there are probably tons of folks that would want to get in on that International Space Station action. I would.
Yeah, we should put in a bid.
Yeah. If we get a sponsor, perhaps we can get a bid for the International Space Station. I mean, I would gladly sell my hashtag moon tent for the International Space Station.
We don't even need the whole station. We just need a pod so we can podcast from our pod.
Oh my
gosh.
International
Space Station.
That's absolutely a thing.
Hashtag pod pod. Cast pod.
Pod cast pod. It's the CADPOS pod. Podcast.
Podcast pod. Oh, man.
Podcast pod. Podcast pod. It's a thing. It's a thing. This podcast is still a thing, despite the name of not a thing. We're happy to have you've joined us for 200 episodes. Don't tell anyone that this is the 200th episode. We'll let them figure it out when the number 200 rolls over. Hope you'll join us then. Hope you'll also join us for the episode in between now and then. We'll probably still produce that one.
Why not? I guess we kind of have to.
Yeah.
And for those of you that have made it this far, you are at the end of the Animal Fries episode. If you're still listening to the sound of our voices, we're going to give you a treat. If you go to the links on our website for this episode, you'll find a link to a SoundCloud page song that I helped write and record. It is a metal song called Shanked by a Unicorn. You're welcome, and I'm sorry.
I can attest to its awesomeness. I'm amazed that you can still talk for this episode.
It's a bit of an effort. I'm not as skilled as Garen, who did the theme song for our podcast.
Right.
He did all the music.
Yes. Yeah, I would. I would say if he didn't point out that you were on, you were doing vocals, I don't think I would have been able to tell.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, your voice is very recognizable on this show anyway. So,
yes.
We'll be back next week. And if you'd like to participate in any of our podcasts, you can visit our Twitter page at Not a Thing Cast, or our Facebook page, Not a Thing Podcast, or the notathingpodcast.com website, and let us know what you think about the show, topics for future shows, sponsorship opportunities, #podpod, and also get information about just us and you know, participate. It's fun. The Not a Thing Podcast thanks you. Brendan, I'll talk to you next week.
Till next time, Alan.